The sense that the ridiculous and the mad and the strange and the real and the comic and the tragic, you know, in a self-evident way, are obviously all mixed up together. That's what life is like. So to have this incredibly strict thing that you're this writer or you're that writer, what kind of books do you write, is what people are always saying to me, and I can't answer that question.
Welcome to the first in a series of podcasts with the author Paul Hoffman. If you have any questions you would like to put forward for the next podcast, please go to Paul's website at www.redopera.co.uk and use the reader's comments contact form. Welcome, Paul.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Without giving away any spoilers, can you explain what the Left Hand of God trilogy is about for anyone that might not have read it?
Yes, let's start with an easy one. There's what something is kind of formally about, I suppose, the kind of plot, and then there's what I'd call the story. Plot is merely a list of the things that happen and go this way or that way. The story of the Left Hand of God really concerns a difficult and rather unpleasant young man called Thomas Cale, who is incarcerated in a kind of huge seminary at some point that maybe the distant past, maybe the distant future, maybe somewhere else, but that bears a strong resemblance to some elements of the world we live in. And he's only been outside the walls of this huge place on a few occasions, and it's subject to an intense religious dogma, which has as its centre the Hanged Redeemer, a god who's come down to earth and sacrificed himself for the benefit of mankind. And this is a couple of thousand years after his death, when the religion has become immensely powerful, but also immensely militarily powerful. One day he stumbles into a particularly difficult and dangerous situation by accident, and he kills one of the priests, a redeemer, and realizing that he's going to die very painfully, he makes a very unlikely bid for escape with two of his, it's hard to say friends, because he's not the kind of person who has friends, but they're both implicated. And really what follows on is his attempt to get away, and after a number of different events and adventures, he ends up in a kind of the complete opposite of the sanctuary, which is where he's been brought up all his life. And it's kind of the most hedonistic, class-based, free, dangerous, extraordinary place that you can imagine, a kind of combination of Paris, New York, and Italy during the Renaissance. There he's unusually, given he's such a difficult and distant person, is befriended by a couple of characters, and he finds himself serving a particularly unpleasant young man who's one of the heirs to the great Materazzi family that runs Memphis. And he tries to make his way through this world with great difficulty, but then the Redeemers, it turns out, are not prepared to let him go, and not just because he's killed one of them. There seem to be some other important reasons.
You say formally that's what this is about, but informally, what is it about?
As the author of two books before the Left Hand of God trilogy, they were both contemporary, what a term I really hate, literary novels about the modern world. And you know, clearly so, they're set in the present. And they're about things ranging from, you know, economics to human relationships to pornography and violence, and a whole range of things that I think are significant about the world we live in now.
That's the Wisdom of Crocodiles and the Golden Age of Censorship.
But I'd also been writing a number of films during that time. And though I'd been successful in getting, I think, three of them made, every screenwriter will tell you what happens is their screenplays are always ruined on the way. And though I was getting well paid, it was incredibly unsatisfactory for obvious reasons. And I've been pursuing a kind of, I hadn't really thought through strategy of, if you like, doing the things that I thought were most difficult and complicated in a novel, because it's obviously much easier, because it's much longer than a film script. And doing things that were more immediate and might have a much wider audience in films. But as that proved to be a complete failure, and the films were just ruined by the way that they were made, I simply then had to think, how was I going to fulfil this desire to bring in as many people as I could, but also do still carry on doing the kind of complex things that I wanted to, and for the widest audience possible. And in a way, that was very easy, because though the modern books were about complicated things in the complicated world in which we live in, I didn't really enter that modern world until I was about 18. I was born in a house without running water or electricity by the light of a paraffin lamp. And we got our water from a well in the garden. So, if you like, I've been born in a world which was, you know, a kind of incredibly ancient world of intense poverty. But then, bizarrely, my father became a soldier and particularly became one of the early pioneers of free fall parachuting. So we then went all over Europe and around the world. And inside this kind of very strange, dramatic, almost primitively mythical world, you know, my first memory of my father was watching him fall out of the sky. And I was surrounded by people who, when I later came to read Homer, I thought, yeah, I know these people, and I know the kinds of things that bother them, the rivalries, the ambitions, the vanity, the determination to excel in some way. So when my father was eventually posted abroad, I was, because there were no schools there, I went to a Catholic school, because we, you know, my parents, coming from Ireland, as they had done when they were adults, were both Catholics. And really I had this weird mixture of almost mythical poverty followed by this almost mythical thing of soldiers jumping out of the air, then spending 10 months of the year inside what ultimately became the sanctuary, this place that was really run like a prison. It was an incredibly violent place and an incredibly enclosed world, which really belonged in its beliefs. And also the attitudes were medieval. It's a medieval religion, in effect, and a 19th century religion. And so an hour's drive away by car in Carnaby Street, the Beatles were changing the face of music and the Rolling Stones. I was stuck in the past. What we all tend to do is we inhabit a kind of rock pool, each one of us, and we kind of mistake that for the way things are. That's what the reality is. But I've been forced, you know, very early on to see how many different lives people lead in different kinds of places. I wanted to try and find a way of writing about the modern world, which wasn't modern. I'd already done that. So what was the point of doing it again? But also I wanted to say, look, all sorts of different people inhabit worlds that are completely strange. You know, we're just a 6-hour plane ride from the Central African Republic, where I think 60% of the people in prison are there on charges of witchcraft. Even inside the country, we have people who inhabit worlds which have vast wealth and immense poverty and almost everything in between. People who live in, you know, worlds where they have gay parents, others where their parents believe that this is a sin against mankind. And that's all in the same country. All these separate competing realities are going on. And I don't think that's really reflected in fiction. And I haven't reflected it before. So I wanted to do something which would, if you like, take us out into another place, another world, if you like, and try and show someone moving through all these incredible contrasting realities that existed alongside one another, and write about that, my experience of being a child and growing up in a world which was very brutal towards children. And that was the other thing, I suppose. I wanted to write about children, not, you know, these are not young adult books. there for everyone. But what I tried to do is say, look, the great central human dramas are being played out in children just as they're being played out in adults. Romeo and Juliet is an example, but there ought to be more. There's no reason why you couldn't play out, Macbeth or a great tragedy in a way that applies to everyone in children. And that's what I've tried to do here.
So having visited that world for 3 books, will you ever return to it in the future and write about it again?
It struck me that in having created a kind of parallel world where almost any period of history can be brought in from the contemporary to the, the ancient and could put them together in new ways, it occurred to me that, look, there's a whole range of things that you can keep doing and keep doing with the central character of Thomas Kail.
Just as a side note, the main character is called Thomas Kail and your son's called Thomas. That's a startling coincidence. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It's just a coincidence, as my son is the, as far as I'm aware at any rate, the least psychopathic of characters. So I'm chalking that down to
laziness.
or to be more generous, coincidence.
So which character out of all of your books is your favourite and why?
Yeah, that's an odd one because it's like your children who you're supposed to not have favourites about, and of course I don't. You would think it would be Thomas Kail, and it is. In a way, he's kind of like too close to home to have it. It's rather like saying, which is your favourite, yourself, your daughter or your son? I mean, it doesn't really make much sense as a kind of question. So I suppose I identify with the character Thomas Kail.
I should point out that his daughter and his son are in the room right now, so he's got to be careful what he says.
So he's not kind of a character in quite the same way as the others are. And I suppose like a lot of people obviously like vague Henri because he's a likeable character. He's the least sort of mad and violent of the 3 boys. And he's based quite closely on a particular friend of mine who was always this incredibly cheerful character. But I have a kind of sneaking liking for Kleist in some ways, because all your characters are bits and pieces of you. But I suppose Kleist has a kind of, in some ways, because he's not quite as extreme as Kail, I like his sense of humour and the way he deals with the world. But also, I suppose, particularly Idris Pika, because he speaks to a kind of pontificating someone who wants to go around telling everyone his opinions about the world. And I like to kind of let that aspect of me off the hook sometimes. But also, he represents a lot of the things that I think as an adult as opposed to think as a teenager. Remember, both of those things are still inside you. And also, he's based on one of my favourite philosophers, Arthur Schopenhauer. A very pithy, witty pessimist, but always very witty and amusing in the way he deals with the world, very realistic about people. And I think people have responded to that very interestingly. I find him quoted all the time on the internet when people, not knowing it, are often quoting Schopenhauer.
What book do you think everybody should read at some point in their life and why, other than obviously your own books?
Obviously, there should be no one book. You should be reading lots of books. There's no such thing as the greatest book ever written. But one that I've always had a really soft spot for, because I read it when I was still the kind of person who virtually never read, certainly never read any good books if I could avoid it. But I picked it up at an airport when I was 14, when it was a mere bestseller. And that's Joseph Heller's Catch 22. And I was an extremely bad an inattentive pupil, to put it mildly, partly out of resistance to the priests. It was a kind of matter of pride to not cooperate in any way whatsoever and not learning anything at all if I could avoid it. It was kind of part of the rebellion. So when I was 16, I failed every O-level it was possible to fail. When eventually I staggered into the sixth form with just enough O-levels to get in, I met a wonderful teacher, Faith Tolkien, who, despite my kale-like animosity and hostility to everything in general, and her in particular, eventually kind of brought me round, and I started working for the first time in my life and became, I think, very much obsessed with literature. And when I couldn't get into any university because my academic record was so bad. But the one place, bizarrely enough, was just down the road, because I was the school was in Cowley, which is a kind of working class suburb of Oxford. The one place that I could get into, because it had an open competition in those days, was Oxford. And so, despite the utter disbelief and dismay of almost everyone else, except for Faith, who was the person who suggested it, I applied. And one of the things I wrote about was Catch-22, because I thought he was much more than a best-selling comic novel. No one ever asked me about it in my interview, but I got in. Then, when it came to doing my a thesis for my degree, I wrote a 5,000-word essay on Catch-22. And rather bizarrely, someone came up to me when I was playing a football match just before I left and said, there's a strong rumour, it's very reliable going around, that they didn't actually mark your essay on, they just gave it a beta plus because they hadn't read it, they didn't think it was worth reading. So that's what it got, don't quote me. I suspect that was probably the case. No one took the book seriously in those days. And gradually over the years, it has just stayed there. It's grown and grown in its reputation. And I'm really rather proud of the fact that, I was putting it ahead in those days. But also I think it's a marvellous book about the modern world. And so funny, but also so sharp in that it takes on so much about how, the world of work, the world of corporations, which, many would say most of us, whether you're a school teacher or you work in the Department of Health and Social Security or you work for Apple or Google, even though it's supposed to be an anti-war novel, it's not really. It's it really brilliantly explores the way in which corporations, structures, organisations work to destroy the individual unless the individual is very careful. And, to promote the inept and the awful and the mad and the deranged over the sensible and thoughtful, and does it in a wonderfully entertaining way. There are just endless numbers of conversations and witty examples of how things actually work in a mad way. And I suppose part of my belief about the world is that, we don't give enough credence to the fact that we're all mad in some way, but some are a lot madder than others. But again, down to the rock pool thing, we can't seem to bear the fact that lunacy is all the way around us and inside us. And no matter where you work, you'll find examples of Catch-22 style insanity. And so I thought that as a modern work, it describes the modern world, its processes, describes the outside world as reflecting the inside world. It doesn't just go into the inside world, doesn't really do that at all. It says anything that's in human beings will be shown in the kind of ridiculous ways in which you come up against the people who, run your life.
What's the best compliment and the most interesting criticism you've had about your work that you'd be willing to share?
Well, as anyone who's, just casually looked at my Amazon page, you can see, plenty of compliments and plenty of insults in kind of almost spectacularly equal abundance. I've always taken the view that And you have to be very careful. I mean, the natural response of human beings to criticism is to regard that anyone who makes one is motivated by jealousy, malice, and envy, and stupidity. And obviously I'm no different, but I can tell the difference between something that is simply kind of stupid sneer and something that's genuine, that puzzled by someone who's actually, you know, wants to like the books or does like the books. And I find that that's very interesting. And even if I don't agree with the criticism, so for instance, a number of people have written into the website, and I've seen the criticism on, you know, Amazon, that they love the books but don't like the ending of the third book. I don't want to kind of give stuff away, but it doesn't end in a great, dramatic, clear-cut fashion. And my view would be, though I knew that was the case, it was, you know, it's deliberate, everyone can see that it's deliberately kind of shifts itself into a new direction, and doesn't follow the mighty ending of The Lord of the Rings or that they're used to expect on things like this, with all the things tied up. That was deliberate. And to tell people, no, you shouldn't, you may not like it, but you should, is obviously redundant. All I can say is that that's my kind of experience of life, and particularly for a character you're going on to, that, you know, things in life don't tend to end in a particularly helpful narrative way when suddenly everything is all right, you know, and they lived happily ever after. You know, that, you know, it's been the saviour of many a terrible sequel that they've decided to, you know, to go back and they don't live happily ever after. And so it simply reflected my view of someone. I mean, after all, it's about someone who's not on a quest. And we're told that, you know, that's what all fiction basically is about, that it's about people who are on quests. And, you know, you've got Bilbo Baggins heading towards the mountain in The Lord of the Rings, and everyone else is trying to bring down the terrible government or the king or the, you know, to survive against the, you know, CIA or the Russians or whatever it is. But he's not really that kind of character. I think he's much more like most of us. He's making it up as he goes along. So it's not a quest book. He's not trying to return home. He's not really trying to get anywhere. You know, he's living almost from day to day. He doesn't really have a grand plan. And so there isn't a conclusion. I think the book doesn't really offer you the promise of a great satisfying conclusion in the conventional way. I think it's satisfying enough, but it definitely changes. But I understand that criticism, and that obviously everyone is writing the book ahead of themselves as they go. And the thing is, I don't know kind of what to say. I mean, a lot of people have criticised the fact that it's got lots of modern names in it. And I've tried to, you know, deal with that explicitly in the last book by explaining where the mixture of modern names comes from. Again, you can't tell people that, you know, that who say they don't like it. Yes, you do. Or you should. You can only explain what it is you're up to. One criticism I have had, and it's not a major one, but I think is right, is that people say that the relationship between Arbel, Swanneck, and Kale is too kind of rushed. It just suddenly happens. And I think that's true. I would do it differently if I were to go back again. As to praise, yeah, I mean, you know, everyone loves praise, of course. but, you know, it was a bit thin on the ground when I was brought up, except for my parents, but I wasn't around my parents very much. So I learnt to be, you know, pretty able to deal without it. And I think it's very important to enjoy praise, but to not make too much of it, and just think about criticism, but not think about it too much. And if it strikes you that there's something you can do about it, then you do it, you admit it, and fine, okay, you know, why should you be perfect? But I remember the one piece of praise that really affected me, and affected my wife as well, was not about these books. It was about The Wisdom of Crocodiles, which I'd spent 13 years writing. And it was a huge pain to get it published. And then when eventually it was published by a very small publisher, there was absolutely nothing. There was no reaction to it at all. Till about 3 months after it was published, when I got a phone call from my agent saying, you know, get a copy of The Telegraph. And we were out shopping for furniture at the time. And it wasn't just that it was a wonderful review when I thought everything had gone, that it just completely vanished after those years of work. It was that it was very detailed and incredibly precise and perceptive, as I would obviously think it if it's good. But it wasn't just, this is the most wonderful book ever written. It went into detail sort of what the books were doing, how they were doing it. And you felt this extraordinary sensation, which is, it's hard to explain to people who think that praise is just praise for, you know, you are the most wonderful writer, this is the greatest book. If someone sets out in detail exactly how they respond to it, you don't know who they are. There's an extraordinary sense of, I didn't think I'd be able to communicate all that fine detail, that they would get everything that was in it. And because it was the first, because it was, you know, extreme, it was brilliant, it wasn't qualified, there was no condescension, you know, there were no buts in it, but it was also so intelligent. That had a big influence on both of us. So much so we decided to celebrate by buying two very expensive chairs, which suddenly proved out to be incredibly uncomfortable, but that's another story.
Changing direction entirely now. Who would play you in a film about your life?
Funnily enough, I wouldn't have been able to answer that question before, and you should obviously make a witty remark of some self-deprecating kind. Harpo Marx, probably. But taking it at face value and taking it more seriously than it deserves to be. I've come across recently, because it's a rather coincidental thing, is actor, what's his first name, Fassbinder?
Michael Fassbinder.
Michael Fassbinder. What's fascinated me about him is for some obscure reason, I assumed he was German, which is pretty odd for someone who's, you know, got equally a German surname. But I was fascinated to discover that like me, he's a sort of Irishman of German descent. And he's such a good actor. I've seen him playing characters in Hunger. I mean, I've got some reservations about Hunger, but everything I've seen him in, he's been absolutely brilliant. And he's got such a range that that would be very good.
And now the question that every writer dreads. What new projects are you working on, and what can you tell us about them?
Not too much, because absolutely no one even knows what the title is beyond my immediate family. But it's, I don't know, the humour in some ways is the same as in is similar to some of the things in The Left Hand of God. But it's, again, a contemporary novel set in the modern world. Mostly in and around London. And beyond that, it is, I hope, completely indescribable, that it doesn't belong in any genre I know of. There are a whole load of them floating on top of one another, which no doubt will irritate a lot of people. But I suppose one of my big bugbears, and a kind of surprise that I had when I... after the release of the Left Hand of God trilogy, was to discover the incredibly strict divisions that exist between genres. And it's a real nuisance that, you know, there are fantasy readers and there's literary fiction and there's crime fiction, and there's no real bleed between any of them, which I think is an enormous detriment to someone like me who's always jumping through them, because after all, life itself doesn't belong in any kind of genre. You know, I'm not, you know, people don't live tragic lives or comic lives. They're not realistic or unrealistic. You know, are they fantasy lives? Well, it depends what you mean. They can't have magic powers. in the external world, but they can certainly have them in their heads, their imagination, their view that, for instance, they are magnificently talented and beautiful when they're, in fact, hideously unpleasant and useless. Or vice versa, they think they're useless and they're actually... So you can't talk about, you know, reality in the way that we've become used to talking about. It just isn't true that that's how the world is. You can't divide it into things. Part of life is pantomime. Pantomime is one of the most important... You know, I don't mean the kind of stuff you're seeing at Christmas starring people from American television series 25 years ago. But the sense that the ridiculous and the mad and the strange and the real and the comic and the tragic, you know, in a self-evident way are obviously all mixed up together. That's what life is like. So to have this incredibly strict thing that you're this writer or you're that writer, what kind of books do you write, is what people are always saying to me, and I can't answer that question. So you get shoved into this category and you can't get out. But hopefully this one will completely defy that. I think really regrettable tendency. Though it may be difficult as to where they're going to put it in the bookshops. I really couldn't care less. And I'm quite a long way into it. I'm probably about 50,000 words in, so I hope it'll probably be out early on next year. And then I'll probably get back to a single novel about kale, taking everything, again, much further, as long as there's something interesting and new to do. I mean, I won't do a Godfather 3 on it and make it for the money or anything like that. I promise that. It's too boring and depressing. And a few other projects, including a music project at the moment. So,
all sounds very interesting. Thank you for talking to us today, Paul.
Very happy to do so.
And remember, if you have any questions you'd like to put forward for the next podcast, please go to Paul's website, which is www.redopera.co.uk, and use the reader's comments contact form. Thank you for listening.